The Reserve Pool, Episode 37, Datum BFF. Hello and welcome to The Reserve Pool, a podcast about Dice Masters and all the people who love to play it. In today's episode, Randy gives us a look at Avengers vs. X-Men Cyclops on a better mic. Chris gives us more advice about building your Dice Masters scene, and we check the mail. Then Evan and I are going to look ahead at D&D Dice Masters and why we're so gosh darn excited. But before any of that, I am Dave, one half of your hosting team, and joining me once again...
The Evan. The other half of the hosting team.
The other half. The better half. Yes, indeed. Don't let Lauren hear that I'm calling you that.
Oh,
but,
my.
You know, that's why I'm in a recording booth, and she's not. Yes.
I can almost feel the dirty look she's giving you right now.
She's nowhere nearby.
but she knows, and she's doing it. You just can't see.
She may well. Well, I've heard it once said, behind every great man is a woman rolling her eyes. I think that was in MASH or something. I don't really remember. All right. So, Evan, you told me recently you finally got to play Cash and Guns.
Yeah. And I mean, at this point, I'm pretty sure everyone knows I'm not really that big on the sort of social engineering, bluffing, guesswork games. I had a blast playing Cash and Guns because, for whatever reason, I just threw, care to the wind. I didn't really care if I won. I didn't really care if I lost. I just wanted to point guns at people and shoot people.
Well, that's the thing. It's not really a social deduction game as much as it's kind of a push-your-luck party game.
Yeah, I mean, there's some degree of that, you know, trying to figure out who has the most money, so you maybe want to point your gun at them, or, given that everybody else is probably going to point at this guy because they have the most money, who can, and they're like this far from the boss, who can I point my gun at to ensure I get best pick of the loot?
There you go, okay.
And I did a little bit of that later, but I just kept on pulling more clips. And by the end of the game, everyone was like, if Evan's pointing his gun at you, you might want to, step out because he shot four people this game.
Well, I'm surprised then that if they thought you were that well armed that you didn't get a lot of guns pointed at you, thus enticing you to drop yours.
No, because I think a lot of, I was making a big deal about taking the clips. And a lot of times I got kind of last pick for loot.
Hmm.
So I think everyone was like, he's not a threat in the sense of why bother pointing our gun at him? He doesn't have a lot of money.
No, okay,
so
that makes
sense. I just sort of wrought havoc throughout the game. I there was one guy I shot twice.
Oh, it's such a fun game. For my part, I finally played Zaya Legends of Idris System. I got that for Christmas, and I've just been itching to get that to the table, and we did so this weekend. We did a little three-player, myself, Lauren, and my brother, and we just did the basic intro five-point game. But wow, all the possibilities that were there, just really cool. I love the way it looks on the table. It's like Twilight Imperium or Eclipse, but instead of on that big macro level that those games are on, it's sort of like you are the one trader. But it's not really just a trading game. It's not really Merchant of Venus or Merchants and Marauders. It's more of a sandbox game. So you can trade, you can pirate, you can smuggle, you can explore. So many different things that you can do. And it was a blast. I'm so glad I got it. And the components are just so sick.
Yeah, that's the one that has all the, really nice metal coins.
Mm-hmm, and the cards have, they're the really nice, linen cards and all that, right. Yeah.
I was actually playing Dig Down Dwarf this weekend.
Not a clue.
That's a recent sort of, mini-game. It's a push-your-luck game. Rolling for your dwarves competing to get the best gems to become Dwarf King. And it actually comes with, piles of little plastic gems. So that was the main reason I got it, because I'm like, oh my god, it's piles of gems, I must have it.
Right.
The jackdaw response just immediately triggered. It's like, shiny, must have. But it was actually a really fun game, and I have a lot of people who are like, I'm not big on just, like, die-rolling push-your-luck games, but this was actually really fun, so...
I'll have to check that out.
Yeah.
The last die-rolling push-your-luck game I got, I was a little disappointed in, and that was Dungeon Dice, which was Tasty Minstrel Games, and it was so close to good, and a lot of people really did seem to get it and like it. It was really well on Kickstarter, and that was really what drove me in. The game looked interesting, but when I got it, it just didn't really seem like there were any interesting decisions to make. There was nothing about it that said, you know, I could pay $15-$20 and get this game, or I could use D6s that I already have and play Farkle, and I'd rather play Farkle.
Yeah, I mean, the big thing with Dig Down Dwarf was, by and large, you had you can spend your victory points to do things, like re-roll dice or set dice to different face so you could get better combo, so you could pick up better things. And we actually had a case where... you needed to roll a straight on your four dice in order to pick up sapphires. And we just kept on drawing more and more sapphires. And we ran around like four times and no one could roll a straight. And we had six of the eight sapphires in the game out. And everyone was just like, gotta do it. And I was like, it was sort of...
Well, that's what
there
makes...
was a lot of like pressure created because it's like, who's gonna get it first? That's like 30 points.
That's what makes a good push-your-luck game, I think, is that balance of risk and reward. The problem with Dungeon Dice was that the decisions were pretty well made for you. Like, if I go deeper, I will lose, and therefore I will lose all of my loot, and so I'm going to stop here. There wasn't a lot of, well, I might be able to do something, because you just... There wasn't enough moving parts of the game to make it work the way they intended. It was a good effort. It was a well-run Kickstarter. And generally, I don't have a beef with Tasty Minstrel, but that one just missed the boat. But something else we really had better talk about.
Oh,
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
I mean, we can not have this part. Was that Dragon Dice, maybe?
Or Dungeon Dice.
Dungeon Dice? Because I remember...
Or Dungeon... Dungeon Roll.
Oh.
Dungeon Roll, people. It was called Dungeon Roll. I'm so sorry. Yes. And it came in a little treasure chest, though. If you were a Kickstarter backer, it came in a mimic. Which was neat, but nonetheless.
Yeah, that's cool.
Well, Evan, there's something else we had better talk about, though, before we finish up the banter, and that is this lovely little contest that we're running right now.
There's a lovely contest going on for the 5th and 6th OP from AVX. We're slightly behind, but we're working on that, hence why we're doing two at once. The basic actions from OP months 5 and 6... And also, we've got several copies of older OP cards, and we're sort of like, we don't know what people want or have, so there's actually the option to go and say, you know, I think we're offering, I believe it's Rally, Teamwork, and Teleport.
So they get to choose.
They get to choose.
Yes,
you know, everyone
cool.
can pick one. We'll give you, the, and you know, if you win, one of the runner-up prizes, you get your old card of choice.
Well, Evan, this sounds great. What do we have to do?
You just have to tell us what art you'd like to change on the cards. Because I know people have said with some of the Marvel Dice Masters stuff that this isn't the best picture or it's kind of bland.
Well, you've said that yourself about Magic.
Yes, I've said that about Magic. I know other people have said this about a few other characters. And I imagine, and you know, all props to WizKids for Yu-Gi-Oh! Dice Masters, but I imagine a few people might have some words about the art on the cards.
Right. All right, well, that sounds good. And please send those emails to contest@thereservepool.com. That'll allow us to parse that. But yes, what art would you like to change? What would you change it to? And why is that a better, you know, why is that more in the character's milieu? Butcher a French word.
Yes, and while I'd originally said that the contest was going to be ending on the 12th, which would be after you listen to this, which it would have already ended by the time you're listening to this, in the spirit of love, we are giving everybody till the 16th.
Very cool. So, yeah, get that to us, contest@thereservepool.com.
And... we look forward to your entries and reading them soon.
Yes, we do. yes, we do. I really want to see what you have to say. Some of the artwork is on the nose, but some of it is not perfect. And there are so many years and years of these comics. There are so many options. So,
right.
All right. Well, Evan, let's see what the rest of the Reserve Pool has to talk about today.
The Reserve Pool reluctantly presents. There and back again. A look back at characters from past sets, and seeing how they may be used differently in newer current sets. Here's your host, Randy. Hey there, gang. Here we are for our second edition of There and Back Again. If you've noticed, the sound quality has improved dramatically. I figured out how to use my mic correctly, so that shouldn't be a problem moving forward. This week, we are looking at Cyclops. Cyclops first appeared in the first issue of X-Men back in 1963. He was, at the time, considered to be Xavier's first ever student. More recent stories, it was revealed that Xavier had other students before Cyclops, mostly Cyclops' older brother, Gabriel Summers, who went by the name Vulcan. For the purposes of most stories, Cyclops is, you know, the epitome of Xavier's teachings. He's always been my favorite X-Man, and I know Chris here at the Reserve Pool agrees with me. More recently, in the comics, Cyclops actually killed Xavier while under the control of the Dark Phoenix, and has been labeled a villain by other members of the X-Men and the Avengers. Cyclops is now leading a renegade group of mutants, still calling themselves the X-Men, but acting more like Magneto did back in the X-Men's early days, where they will fight against mankind for the rights of mutants. I really like Cyclops' character development since the death of Xavier, and I love his new costume. That new costume is the one that is shown on the Uncanny X-Men card, the red and black with the X visor. But right now, we're going to talk about the AVX card. Cyclops is only one of two characters that has the same fielding cost on all three faces. The other one is Iceman. So when you buy Cyclops, you know exactly how much he will cost to field every single time. That's really nice when you're trying to count energy you will need. He's got 4 attack and 2 defense on level 1, 5 attack and 3 defense on level 2, 6 attack and 4 defense on level 3. First, looking at his common, Slim. When Cyclops is blocked by more than one character, he deals damage equal to his full attack to each character blocking him. This character costs 5 cost, and I wanted to bring this one up first because, just like Dr. Octopus that I talked about last week, this card has some serious potential moving forward. If we can give this Cyclops Overcrush, and we can force multiple characters to block him, then he could win the game in one turn. Right now, though, it's just not possible. You would need to use Throne Car basic action, coupled with using Cable's global ability multiple times, which costs 2 bolts to activate every time. And you're looking at just way too much energy and die roll the right way to make this work. It could, in the perfect scenario, just like we said about Doc Ock, but for practical planning, it's not reliable. The rare, Cyclops Scott Summers, 7 cost. If Cyclops is blocked, you may have him deal damage to your opponent instead of his blocker. If you do so, he goes to your used pile during cleanup. This is good because he's essentially unblockable. This card is interesting because you have to make the decision when Cyclops is blocked. So as soon as blockers are declared, you can decide if he's going to deal his attack damage to the player or not. There is not time for globals to be played when you make your decision. You can bump up his attack power with Enrage or Invulnerability, and then attack, but you need to make sure you do those things before you attack, because there is not time to do them, because you do not get a chance to play the globals after the blockers are declared. The 7 cost that was a big deterrent is now, you know, null and void with the PXG. That's honestly the biggest difference in so many of these cards we're looking at. Well, it was ignored in the first place because its purchase cost is too high. Well, the purchase cost being too high isn't a factor anymore, because if you really want it, almost all of these cards that we're going to be looking at, you can get now by the second or third turn very, very consistently using the Professor X Global. Next is the Cyclops that was probably the most widely used version of Cyclops through AVX. The uncommon, If Looks Could Kill. When Cyclops is assigned to attack, before blockers are assigned, he deals his attack in damage to each opposing character. Which, I'm going to be honest with you for a minute here, I think that's one of the coolest names of a card in the entire AVX series. I mean, just looking through my binder right now, I mean, we have character cards that have nicknames that we know them as. You know, Ghost Rider, Johnny Blaze, Green Goblin, Goblin Lord, Deadpool, Assassin, Venom, Eddie Brock, The Thing, Everlovin' Blue-Eyed. And we have some that give their names, we have some that give a nickname, some that give a description, but there are few as clever as If Looks Could Kill. I'm actually reviewing this card at the perfect time. I just played a game with a friend of mine earlier today. His name's Tom. Hey Tom, how you doing? I know you're listening out there. He used a team that focused on getting Cyclops If Looks Could Kill out early. He purchased him by second or third turn, both games we played today, using the Professor X Global, and he was used to perfection. I mean, he comboed it up with the Green Goblin, Goblin Lord, and Gambit, Ace in the Hole, a couple of commons. So he was buying some three-cost characters, constantly being able to use the Professor X Global, and by, I want to say, fourth or fifth turn, he was able to attack with Cyclops, Green Goblin, and a couple of sidekicks. Cyclops wiped out my line of defenders, came through with a beefy attack stat. He might have even pumped the attack stat up with the invulnerability global, I don't quite remember. But then the Green Goblin gives plus one attack, plus one defense to sidekicks. So he has Cyclops, Green Goblin, and a couple of sidekicks all coming through after he wiped out my side. That's on the fourth or fifth turn because their fielding costs are so low. It was a great setup. I was really impressed by it. If Looks Could Kill has always had a spot on people's teams, and that seven cost was difficult, but he was a late game win condition. You build up your force, you get some attackers, and then late in the game you buy Cyclops and you rush with everyone. Cyclops wipes out your opponent's defenders, everyone gets through for the win. But now, he's not a late game win condition card. He's an early to mid game purchase that can keep your opponent, you know, crippled for a few turns while you finish him off. He's so much more usable now with the Professor X Global, and it's thematic. It's Professor X working with Cyclops. So I think that just about wraps up our look at Cyclops. Real quick recap. We have Slim, which just like the Doc Ock that we talked about last week, there's so much potential moving forward if we could easily give him Overcrush and the ability to draw blockers to him. But nothing like that exists that is currently released. The rare, Scott Summers, is really good. But, you know, it still might not be worth the 7 purchase cost, especially when you compare it right next to If Looks Could Kill, which with the Professor X Global, he is no longer just a late-game finishing move. He is an early to mid-game force of nature. So yeah, he's one of my favorite X-Men, and go ahead, try him out. Maybe you can find a spot for him on your team now. That's all for me. Hope you guys enjoyed this segment. Go ahead and leave a comment in the section below, and we'll get one of your favorite characters from an older set up here on the podcast next time. This has been There and Back Again with your host, Randy. Back to you guys.
Welcome to Refilling Your Dice Bag, the Reserve Pool's guide on building a local Dice Masters community. This is Episode 3, Events, Events, Events. In the first two episodes of this segment, we discussed at length about connecting with an FLGS, a friendly local game shop, and connecting with players on an individual level to kickstart interest and player buy-in for Dice Masters and your community. Today we're going to assume that so far you've been outrageously successful. Nice work. You've got the support of a game store owner who's ordering product and offering you table space to play. And look at that. You even got a few interested players who are buying product and starting to get interested in playing the game in an organized fashion. Now what? What do you do next? Step 3 of successfully planning a Dice Masters community is creating and maintaining a reliable calendar of events. Now I'm going to spend the rest of our time here talking about what that means and what those event types could look like. If you expect to generate buzz about a game in your local gaming circle, you have to give people the opportunity to play it. We talked about carrying it around with you and offering to get it to the table whenever possible in the last segment. Let's transition from just running demos and enter an entirely new realm, offering events. Now, events are the absolute key to success when it comes to a collectible game, either thriving or dying. The buzz you might be able to generate personally won't last forever, and you've got to harness that energy into something sustainable. So, here's my advice. First, grab a calendar. I don't care if it's digital or paper or scratched out on a cave wall, just make sure it's the right year. Then mark out a few dates for yourself in big letters that you'll remember. What should they be? Well, there are three important events that are catalysts for game growth. The demo, the open play, and the tournament. First up is the demo, and it's exactly what it sounds like. If you've been doing your best at evangelizing Dice Masters, you've probably already been running demos for your friends. Now take what you've been doing and apply it on a mass scale. There are a few keys to a good demo. First, be willing to let your collection be handled. Now, I don't care if you sleeve or don't sleeve or clean your dice with wet wipes. I don't care. Realize that your target audience for this demo probably has no Dice Masters product whatsoever, and they have to try somebody's out. If the store has some demo material, great, but be willing to lend your own out. Second, make sure the store has product to buy immediately. Right then, right there. The point of the demo is, hey, try this new game out. Did you like it? Great, you can buy it here. I recommend a starter set, a playmat, at least 10 boosters to get you going. You know what I'm talking about. Third, don't be stressed by teaching lots of games and fielding lots of questions. Better yet, get some help from an initiated friend. If you don't have help, just realize that you're doing what you're doing for a reason. Grin and bear it and think of the results. How often should you do a demo? Well, that depends. At least for the first few months of your scene. After a time, the player base will gain some strength, the new players will be brought in through current players, and the role of demoer will fade away. I suggest at least one demo a month for maybe 3 months. When should you do it? Well, make sure you've got a 2 to 3 hour block of time blocked out for just Dice Masters at least. If evening store hours are a concern, just pick a Saturday or a Sunday for your demos. Next is open play. Now, open play is exactly what it sounds like. The time is designated as a Dice Masters open play. So there's tables with seats provided to grab some games at. Players bring their own teams and collections, and games are casual, not necessarily timed unless agreed upon by players, and the players run the time themselves. If you ask me, this is the heart of your gaming community, or at least the pulse. This is where tournament teams are tested, where characters prove themselves in the field of battle, where heroes are born and dreams die in flaming ashes as strategies fail and... Sorry, I got carried away. You catch my drift. In an ideal world, and if you love the game as much as me, your store holds an open play once a week. It's probably got table space for just a couple of hours, but those hours belong to Dice Masters. Usually the best time for open play is a weekday evening, but it really depends on the nature of your community schedule. For example, open play every Tuesday night from 7 to 9 is a solid format to follow after. Last, but quite certainly not the least, is the tournament. Aha, this is what most of us competitive gamers live and die for in a game. The chance to use our hard-earned experiences during open play and over Google Hangouts and poring over lists and turn it into that coveted OP card or store prize or just bragging rights. I'm going to spend the entire next segment of refilling your dice bag on successfully running a tournament, so I'll save the details for then. How often should you host a tournament? Well, at the current rate that WizKids releases its organized play kits, once a month. I always recommend tournaments be scheduled on the weekends, as the majority of players can find time on a weekend. Make sure you keep a 4 to 5 hour block of time, including setup, in mind for tournament play. If you keep a calendar full of varying types of events like these, you're destined to see Dice Masters blossom in your community. On the next episode of Refilling Your Dice Bag, we'll take a long look at the do's and don'ts of organizing a tournament. Thanks for listening, and always remember, games are only fun when we're playing them together.
Yeah, Chris, definitely some good thoughts there, and hopefully, you know, a little bit later this month, I will be having the first demo day at a store. And Evan, I know you finally got to do a little bit of demoing
well. That's maybe a little... I actually did get to do a little bit of demoing, though. I set up a demo day at my local game store, and unfortunately, it was scheduled at the same time as a tournament. So everyone was there and sort of focused on something else. So I'm actually giving it another shot. I think I'm going to be persistent. I've only begun to fight for Dice Masters.
Yeah, you really have to. That just wasn't an ideal day to have it scheduled. And the store hopefully can work some better stuff out with you.
Yeah, no, I mean, especially because I have a feeling that if I don't, like, get a crowd playing it, I suspect the store is going to actually stop carrying it possibly not even have D&D Dice Masters, which would be a tragedy.
It would be a tragedy. I'm sure that it'll come around, just not on a day when there's a tournament for something else and everybody's right. like, tournament time!
Yeah,
so.
I'm hoping to go when the HeroClix players are around, because I think those are the people to talk to.
That could be true. Well, when D&D comes out, maybe, well, the Magic the Gathering crowd, but we'll get to that. And then Randy, of course, was talking about how the Professor X Global makes Cyclops a lot more viable, especially if looks could kill. And he's right, but I think it affects a lot of the six costers that way as well.
Yeah, though it certainly affects your ability to buy little guys, too. I mean, energy is energy.
Absolutely, it is. And if it can speed up an aggro deck, it's going to, you know, effectively, you haven't really changed. Excuse me. And if it can speed up an aggro deck, effectively, you haven't really changed a whole lot with a tempo. So, you know, that's the double-edged sword of the globals, of course.
Right. It speeds everybody up.
It sure does. All right. Well, let's move on to the mail. Let's take a peek into the Reserve Pool mailbag, and you can find your letters in there if you send an email to mailbag@thereservepool.com. And, of course, you can email us individually, Dave, Randy, Evan, Chris, @thereservepool.com, and something interesting there might end up on the show as well. Just keep that in mind. If you definitely don't want us to use something on the show, just let us know you're writing in just to correspond and whatever else. But we'd love to be able to use it on the show. In any case, Dustin wrote in thanking us for the draft discussion. He had a great time at his first event, and he went 2-1, and that's awesome. Way to go, Dustin. I'm glad that it was a success. He had so many positive things to say about how it went, so I don't know who out there listening might have been at that event too, but it sounds like repping the community well. I love it all around. He wants to know, what one rule would you change about the game? For example, he would like actions to stay in reserve if unused. You could play them anytime. You could play a global on an opponent's turn and have them clear at your clear and draw step. Or would we remove the 20 life cap, make teams up to 10 characters, roll 5 dice on your first turn, or some other rule you wish was gone or tweaked? Thanks, and keep up the great work. Well, thank you, Dustin. Evan, what are your thoughts?
Honestly, that's sort of my wish. I think we're starting to get that with some of the things we're seeing in Yu-Gi-Oh! And
sorry, what, the action dice one?
Yeah, the action dice. I'd sort of like a little more strategic use of them. On the other hand, with stuff we're seeing in Yu-Gi-Oh! And to an extent D&D, and we'll talk about that a bit shortly. We're starting to see more of action dice not just being, and you could, they're no longer just sorceries. Which, to borrow a magic term. And I approve of that.
Well, yeah, that's fair.
Yeah, you know, I think that's my big one.
There are a lot of people who want to see some things that are a little more Magic the Gathering-like in this game, and sometimes I agree with that, but I don't know. Anymore, I don't know, because in Magic the Gathering, there's far more hidden information than there is in this game, right? You know all the teams and the cards that are there, and you can pretty easily figure out what is in your opponent's dice bag and what's out there and what they can do and when. So there's not a lot of mystery. It's really a lot about execution and reacting to the strategy. It's like a miniatures game without tactical movement in some ways.
Well, but, I mean, there is some randomness going on, but
absolutely.
It's a lot harder to get, you know, it's a lot easier to say, well, my opponent has bought these 7 dice, and they have 3 sidekicks in their bag, so they're probably going to get this.
Right.
As opposed to, my opponent is playing the slide deck. I've seen 15 of his 60 cards, which means he could draw anything now, so who knows what's in his hand?
Well, if it's constructed in Magic, right. I guess you probably know their deck list, but nonetheless,
it's a lot harder to just say, I know what you're going to
do next
turn.
Of course.
And plan.
Well, and there's a lot of bluffing that ends up involved, right? You know,
right.
You're playing against that person with a blue deck, and they leave, like, 1 and 2 blue untapped, and it's like, oh, are they going to bounce my creature? They're going to counterspell, and now you don't quite know what to do. You know, it's harder for that to be a facet in this game, because if you have distraction and they have the energy, then you know what might happen. So, there are a couple of things that might be interesting. I could see summoning sickness, so then a mechanic of, like, haste could be a thing. Or that attacking means that you can't block with that creature. You know, you can effectively tap a die, and since it's a die, it should actually avoid WotC's patent on tapping, which I think is set to expire soon. I'm really not sure. Trademark, patent, something. They have something that's binding. But
personally, I don't like the idea of summoning sickness being added to Dice Masters. I don't have like a strong reasoning for this. I like sort of the mechanic of I get a guy out and I can attack with him. Because it's very different. Yeah. Most games, usually you get a guy out and he has to sit and wait.
That's fair. Well, that's true. It does make it a little more immediate, and it would serve to slow down the game. So I guess I'm fine with that. I think maybe, you know, having to tap your die to attack could be pretty interesting. Perhaps something with a prep area where there's a delay there for your opponent to reroll. But one thing you brought up really gave me some thoughts. I've been reflecting a lot on the sealed game of Yu-Gi-Oh! That Lauren and I played, and you can find that video on our YouTube channel, and please subscribe to that as well. And it was a lot of fun getting cards that we hadn't really seen before and trying to structure a coherent team out of them. So 10 characters, I'm with you, Dustin, and that's something that we're going to throw out there in Sealed, which I may already have an article up about how to play Sealed. So once again, Dustin, thanks for writing in, and to everybody else, mailbag@thereservepool.com. Next set up is the set that we are all looking forward to. Every one of us at the Reserve Pool, it looks, if you ask us anyway, it looks to put this game up against Magic the Gathering and then put Dragonfire in the face of that game. And we're talking, of course, about Dungeons & Dragons, Dice Masters, the Battle for Faerun, or as we're calling it, Datum BFF.
Yes, because that is the best possible acronym. I mean, yes. Maybe not the best possible acronym, but it's pretty awesome.
We could just stick with BFF. I mean, we call AVX and UXM and YGO. This is the BFF set.
It's Yu-Gi-Oh! Does Yu-Gi-Oh! Even have a subtitle? I think all the others is
Series
Marvel
1.
Series 1. So, yeah. Technically, it should be S1.
Or just YGO 1.
Yeah.
Perhaps. But regardless of any of that, I do think that this set will end up being the BFF for Dice Masters. Uncanny X-Men came, and it was exactly what this game needed. And we talked about that recently on the blog with the Why Dice Masters is Thriving post. And Yu-Gi-Oh! Came, and while some people like the Yu-Gi-Oh! IP and some people don't, and some people just want the set because it's more Dice Masters, regardless of the IP, Kent and I brought some really nifty abilities into the fold in certain things that we had wanted. But my gosh, does Dungeons & Dragons look incredible. So, Evan, you've written a lot of spoiler articles about this, and we've all watched the videos of people playing. Why don't you tell us just your general impressions, your overview of the look and feel of this set?
I mean, I really think they've sort of knocked it out of the park with this one. They're stealing the D&D fonts, which, you know, if you got it, why not flaunt it? They're using art from D&D, which we've said in the past is fantastic overall. And I think just the visual design on the cards, really good. There's lots of like neat little band. It's not just like, oh, and there's the Avenger emblem just sort of stuck on. It's like, oh, they're like, it's sort of like a nameplate with, you know, a flag hanging off of it, and it flows together, and there's little doodads coming off because this guy can use equipment. And I really just love how the cards look so far.
Oh, you have, and like the sort of transparency, the opacity of the ability text area, and actually even the darker gray on the bottom, I still see some opacity there, or even actually of everything on the card. Like, you can kind of, the artwork flows more because there's opacity to this stuff around it, whether it's where the cost is or where the ability text is or even down by where the dice are listed, and that's really cool. It makes the card feel a lot fuller.
Yeah, I mean, that, and from what we've seen of the dice, looking at the Dice Tower demo game played with D&D stuff, the dice look really nice too.
Yeah.
Like they all look pretty crisp there, and they're getting a lot of really nice and striking colors. Orcs aren't green, but they are red, which means they will go faster. We'll get into that.
And of course, there are no serial numbers.
Yes.
So if you're not...
I honestly, now that I have some Yu-Gi-Oh! Dice, I find that doesn't really bother me.
Yeah, the serial numbers, like, don't even... I don't even notice them, and they're never going to impact me in any way, shape, or form. So, yep. But anyway, there are none. Some people aren't going to like it no matter how minimal an impact. Some people just don't like the idea of it, and I get that.
Which is fair.
It's not here. Yeah, they don't have it here. So, yeah, Evan, I'm pretty much with you. The graphic design on these cards is just stunning. I mean, not just the art direction, which obviously they had great source material to go off of with the D&D 5 artwork, but the kind of like the gold filigree around the different areas of the card, the gold shadow outline of the dice listing at the bottom of the card, everything. And, of course, that D&D 5 artwork just sings. The font is a much better selection.
Well, the font is specifically the one that, like, if you grab your player's handbook or whatever, you'll notice it's the one they use for the boldface, their small caps font.
No, you're correct, but just everything looks a lot tighter. The use of the outline, white outline on black text for the number at the top. I believe that's different. Just the detail here is crazy, and this might be something that they only do with Yu-Gi-Oh sets with Dungeons and. And this might be something they only do with the Dungeons & Dragons sets, and they might keep the superheroes a little more, clean and, less chromey and more kind of, comic books are clean lines and panels and everything like that traditionally, so I'm okay with that. This looks awesome, and I certainly wouldn't be upset if they made the superhero sets look a little bit different, too, in the future.
Clean them up a bit.
Yeah, wow. So we have to talk about some of the new mechanisms that are coming in here as well. I'm excited about pretty much all of them. I don't even know where to begin.
Let's go over a couple are just really giving official names to mechanics we've already seen.
Sure.
Energy drain is spin down formalized. After blockers are assigned, spin each character, engage with this character down one level. We've seen stuff like that on, some Black Widow card or another.
That's a great name for it. I mean, well-named. Some people made fun of Overcrush. I think it's fine. But Energy Drain, I don't think anybody can argue with. That's great.
Right. And there's also Regenerate, which I'm not sure if we've seen the exact mechanic before. But we've definitely seen characters who, when they get knocked out, roll them. Do something with them, and if it happens, they come back. Regenerate in this case is if character gets knocked out, you roll it. If you roll character face, it stays in the field.
Yes.
Though it does state that since it was knocked out, it does qualify for experience, which we'll talk about in a minute, because that's a cool one, and we really should talk about it, so...
Yeah, those couple are pretty straightforward. And, of course, we have Overcrush in here and everything like that, too. But then let's go on with equipment, which kind of uses basic actions, or well, not basic actions, but I suppose the non-basic actions in ways like Dustin was hoping for in the mailbag segment.
Right. Equipment is basically when you field an equipment die, or a die with equip is the official term.
Okay.
At the beginning of the time, each turn it's active, and when it's fielded, and it's important to note that when it says at the beginning of each turn, it specifies your turn or your opponent's turn. So it's not just on your turn. You can attach that die to a character with there's a little like crossed hammer and I think it's a pick icon.
And that means they can use equipment.
Yeah, and that means they can use equipment. And you can just sort of switch it around. And I like that you can switch it. It's not just on your opponent. It's, at the beginning of your opponent's turn, if you're like... Well, I guess the only real question now is when they say the beginning, does that mean like before they draw? When they draw? When?
Yeah, I think it would be like right at the clear and draw step, likely.
Right, but I guess you get to see what your opponent draws first, because if your opponent draws, like, and I draw all my huge guys, maybe you want to put that, magic shield, which we haven't seen, but I can't imagine there won't be one at some point. Maybe you want to put that magic shield on that guy you don't want to get knocked out.
I think it might be a little more akin to how, a lot of people use the Professor X Global, like, okay, at the beginning of your turn, my turn's done, at the beginning of your turn, I do the thing. Right. I think it's probably going to happen there, probably maybe even slightly before the draw. I don't know if we're going to see sort of a, it's there, but we're not calling it that, upkeep phase in this game, like Magic has. There are a lot of little mini phases in Magic that go ignored sometimes, too. Like, there's actually a beginning of attack step before... attackers are actually declared. So there's like one other little window of priority there. It's crazy. But, you know.
You should check out if the Warhammer 40,000 Conquest rules. They actually have a full diagram of all the opportunities for doing stuff in a turn.
It's actually a really interesting
way of thinking about how the turns go.
Well, and priority is a little bit more straightforward in this game, too. But, yeah, I would imagine we'll see... I think it's going to be effectively used as something like that, because the beginning of your opponent's turn implies your opponent hasn't done anything.
Right.
So.
But, yeah, I mean, it fits... I mean, this is what I expect we're going to see. Magic swords and magic rings and magic hats and all kinds of stuff. And
well, what's just, D&D it's without
completely
your,
fitting.
What's yeah, D&D it, without your plus one sword?
Right. Or your boots of striding and springing, which I think are just striding now. But
yeah,
lost the jump.
let me ask you this, and I just want to make sure that I'm not reading too much into this. They mentioned at the beginning of each turn that this die is active, but if I want to keep it on the character that it's currently on, I don't have to pay that again, right? You're just paying that initial equip cost. Well, okay, yeah.
Yeah, you don't actually have to. It really looks like, because another thing they say is, if a character to which this die is attached leaves the field, the die remains in the field unattached. Yeah. So equipment dice, you buy them, they go to your bag, you get them, you play them, and they stay in your field forever.
Yeah, that's really cool. Well, of course, I'm sure we'll see ways to destroy equipment and things like that.
My money has I have some money on a disintegrate spell, or basic action, or not basic action, that will allow you to destroy equipment.
Perhaps. Wouldn't it be cool? I guess this is getting a little more Dragonlance rather than, I believe, Battle for Faerun is more Forgotten Realms. But perhaps, you know, I think of the Draconians who you kind of lose the thing. Certain ones of them, like they'll turn to stone or something. You lose the weapon that you used.
Right.
So, yeah, who knows? But, oh, that's really cool and very thematic with D&D.
Right. Speaking of thematic with D&D, that experience mechanic we were talking about, basically, creatures with experience, if an opposing monster was knocked out, you get an experience token on a card for every card that has experience. So if I have, like, my Halfling Thief and my Dwarven Cleric, and both of them have experience, and I knock out a gelatinous cube on my turn, both of them get an experience token. For every experience token on a card, all that card's dice get plus one attack and defense at all levels.
Yes, so plus one tokens enter the stage here in this game, and that's pretty cool too. Something that's going to be, you know, very familiar to and comfortable for those who are transplants from other CCGs. And that's just really cool. I mean, that's probably going to be limited to certain types of characters. Like, I can't imagine we're going to have dragons gaining experience. You know, it's probably more like the characters who are traditionally in that hero sort of role. You know, your barbarians and your fighters.
Yeah, they actually, looking at the text for experience, they pretty much almost outright say that.
No, well, that's fine. That makes, again, thematic, makes sense, but very, very cool. And, of course, it's worth mentioning that you can only get experience if you were attacking and stuff got knocked out. You know,
and if your opponent knocks out a creature to pay a cost during your turn, that also doesn't give experience. So
right. You
have to
be engaged.
Knock out a character, knock out a monster dealing damage. My only question, we actually saw this in the Dice Tower video, there's sort of a question of like, well, if D&D is playing with experience against a set that isn't D&D, what do you do?
Well, like, and that's,
are there just no monsters?
I guess. Maybe.
I don't know. I'm actually reading, like, they say, knocking out NPCs in other adventures, and for what it's worth, NPCs are what we're calling sidekicks in D&D Dice Masters, does not provide experience tokens, only knocking out monsters. So you could make an argument like superheroes aren't monsters, so
no.
You don't get experience for beating them.
But in Yu-Gi-Oh! Everything is a monster. So, yeah, it's hard, except that we've been told that monsters and characters are interchangeable in that sense. So,
right. Yeah,
that's what you're going to have when you mix up some of these IPs, but I don't think that's a big deal because I don't have a problem with mixing. I think it can be fun, and I enjoy coming up with crazy constructed teams. I really do. But I want to play, this stuff looks awesome, and it's going to work so well together all on its own. I don't even want to have, like, Cyclops coming into my D&D and killing a beholder. Though that could be an interesting fight.
I-beam fight begin.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Actually, I kind of want to do that. Never mind.
And the best part, we're not even done with the new abilities. There's two left. We've got Breath Weapon, which Breath Weapon is when you assign this character to attack, you may pay X, because all the Breath Weapons are going to be like Breath Weapon 1, Breath Weapon 2, Breath Weapon 3. When you assign that die to attack, you can pay X energy to deal X damage to your opponent and each opposing character, because this tends to be on dragons, and what do dragons do but breathe stuff all over everything?
See, that's awesome. Very thematic. It does a lot of damage, but these dragons, even at the lowest level, even at breath attack 1, and this is one generic energy, by the way, and that's codified in the rule book, but that's basically how it works. Kind of like if...
It is notable that you have to pay X. You can't pay less than X, so you can't be like, I have my super rare red dragon, and he's got breath weapon 3, so I can pay 2 and do 2 because I only have 2. No, you have to have the 3.
Yeah, you have to pay exactly that cost. So, there is some limitation to that. But, it is powerful, but the dragons tend to be, kind of pricier to get out there, and that is what it is. The blue dragon has a weaker breath weapon. It's just 1. But, you're going to have to constantly be doing that. And,
which
it also has an ability that does damage to all characters whenever you use an action die's ability. So, even your own. So there's obviously a drawback to having the power of that breath weapon out there.
Right.
Something that would be cool in future sets, and I don't want to get ahead of ourselves here, but like Dragon Fear, where humanoid characters, when this character comes out, pick 2 humanoid characters that your opponent has and move them to the used pile or the prep area or something like that. Dragon Fear is a big thing in Dungeons & Dragons as well. So.
Well, they're toning it down a little, but yeah. Dragon Fear used to be a very big thing. And there's one more, which is really cool. It's Swarm. While you have a character with... or a die of a character with Swarm active, whenever you draw one of that character's dice from your bag during clear and draw, you draw one additional die. You can only draw one die, no matter how many copies of the die. So the one we've seen with this is Orc. Or the Orc. And so if you have an Orc out, or rather, if you have 3 orcs out and you draw an orc, you get to draw 1 die. Hmm. So the 3 orcs don't get to draw 3 dice, just 1. However, if you have 1 orc out and you draw an orc, you get to draw a die. If that dies an orc, you get to draw another die. If that dies an orc, you get to I'm starting to sound like, a comedy sketch because infinite orcs, but it's a neat little draw mechanic, and it could I have a really hard time seeing aggro decks not abusing the heck out of this.
Yeah, and of course everybody's going to want to find a way. So yeah, so those are the mechanisms. Equip, breath weapon, swarm, experience, energy drain, regen. But there's something else really cool that this brings to this set, and I'm especially geeked by this, which is affiliations as well as alignments. So we have the good, neutral, evil, as you might expect from Dungeons & Dragons. They sort of made it a little more basic because there's actually a lot more alignments than that, like 9.
Right.
But whatever.
Well,
you know,
it depends on... 5th has the basic 9, but I believe 4th edition smushed it to kind of like 5 or something.
Fair enough. But
and, they occasionally try other things.
Yes. But we also have affiliations that characters are going to be with. Not everybody, but some of them. So they may be a part of the Emerald Enclave, or the Harpers, or the Lord's Alliance, the Order of the Gauntlet, or the Zentarium. I almost said Zentarium there. And they also have a flag that's just monsters. So
these are really like synonymous to the Avengers and X-Men sort of thing. Alignment is a more different one of these, I think.
Right, but, well, there's a couple things. There's a combination of it, and I think the way they've set it up, what I'm hoping, and I haven't seen enough cards to know this yet. We've seen a fair amount of cards, but I don't think enough to know this. What I feel like, though, is that there's going to be a lot more thematic stuff happening within each within each affiliate group. And, I mean, obviously monsters are monsters, and that's what they are, but especially the other five. The thing that really geeks me about this is, you know, some of the most successful sets in Magic the Gathering, you know, like Ravnica, or, of course, Return to Ravnica, or now with Khans of Tarkir, have had a strong, like, color guild affiliation that goes with different combinations of things. And that has really seemed to inspire a lot of players, at least that was my impression. I thought Ravnica was cool. In fact, that brought me back after a number of years hiatus with the game. And we're going to kind of get a little bit of a taste of that here. I think it's something a little bit different from just the superhero team affiliations.
Right, yeah. And you're also seeing, I like what they're doing with the sub names for the characters, where before it was, you know, Iceman, Too Cool, or, you know, what, or so on. Here you'll have sort of a rarity, you know, this is an apprentice, this is a lesser, this is a master, this is an epic, and then a type. And this is, we've already seen that's going to be used by a few cards to sort of define things. You've seen the Dwarven Cleric card, which doesn't take damage from undead. So it'll be interesting. It's like sort of a third. They don't have a nice little picture for it, but it's sort of a third grouping.
Right.
Of cards, which we're already seeing things abuse. And we saw a little bit of this with Yu-Gi-Oh! With dragons, but...
We're really opening the door here.
But yeah, it seems like they're doing a lot more with it this time.
And that is so exciting to me. And again, as we said many times leading up to the Yu-Gi-Oh! Set, these are things that we talked months ago about. Oh, I hope we see something like this. That'd be really cool. Or that would work well. Here it is. That's so awesome.
Right. Yeah.
This stuff's been in development for a while, so we're not going to take any kind of credit. But it's exciting. It's so exciting.
Yeah. I mean, I'm just really psyched for how many awesome things they're putting in with all the neat abilities and all the interactions between the various flavors of affiliation every character has.
Yes.
Just sort of looking at experience, and it's now like, oh man, there's so much risk reward. All these monsters are really cool, but then someone comes along with like four experienced guys, and I can't let my guys get knocked out ever because I'll lose.
Well, and we're going to have to look a lot more at ways to mitigate then as well, and that's,
yeah,
mitigation strategies are going to become important. Yeah, I'm hoping we see a lot more removal and things like that as well.
Right, because now we're looking at like, well, I want to churn. Like before, it's been like, oh, I'll send this guy out if he gets knocked out. It's churn. Now, maybe you can't churn so well.
Yeah, or you don't. It's like, do I want to block and make that thing more powerful, or and then, you know, potentially, you know, close up my field and clear out my field and who knows what I'm going to get? Do I want to let him through and take that damage? It's just, there's a lot more decisions. And well, let's move into that then. Let's reflect then on what all of this means. I mean, for one, combat means so much more with experience. KOing really matters on both sides, because it's now not just letting your opponent roll more if you have certain characters who can be buffed up because of it. And that's going to make the decisions around the attack step for both players a lot more interesting.
Yeah, I mean, to an extent, I've always found that... Well, I won't say, oh, there's nothing behind figuring out what you're going to attack with, because that's not the case at all. But I've definitely thought sometimes, you know... Sometimes I'd attack and just, you know, okay, I'll just attack with this guy because my opponent can't do anything to knock him out. And he might block, and, you know, all he has are some sort of pricey characters. So if he blocks with those, he's locked them out, and maybe he won't get them back, or at least have to pay a bunch of energy to get them back, so he can't do as much stuff with his turn. And, you know, whatever. And now maybe you can't make those decisions quite as well, because, you know, maybe he'll pull something out, you know, maybe he has that energy, and maybe you won't know if he's gonna, you know, you don't know necessarily if he's gonna, okay, yeah, so I'll actually spring out knocking your guy out, or,
well, sure,
a whole bunch of, you know, or do something crazy, especially now with, you know, you don't necessarily know where he's going to reassign stuff.
Like equipment. With equipment, my goodness. Yes.
You know, maybe he's going to reassign equipment on his turn, and you know, now he can knock out your guy, and, you know, now you lose him, and, oh, your monster got knocked out, so all of his guys that he's drawing next turn are +1/+1, and that's enough extra damage to knock you out.
Oh, well, geez, absolutely. Breath Attack adds another interesting wrinkle there, but... You know, the decision before was oftentimes, okay, I'll throw this weak thing out there. It'll knock something out of mine. Maybe it'll knock something out of theirs, but I'll take that trade-off. You know, this is just one die out of many that I have out here. So I'll take that trade-off so I get to roll something extra next turn. And sometimes you just do that, and that would be that. And then maybe the sacrifice is, well, you give them something else. Well, you know, now the sacrifice for your opponent of blocking is, okay, now I get a die in prep too, but so does my opponent. Okay, fine. But now maybe that... you know, opponent also gets a 1/1 token. You know, so you have to pay more attention to what am I going to block with? Or, jeez. I mean...
And I think there's just, with Breath Weapon, it's so much less of the, like, I'll just stockpile, like, my 4D sidekicks out. And there's a little less of that. I can just have my sidekicks sitting here acting as sacrificial blockers and, you know, maybe... extra avenues for me to pump +1 attacks into when they inevitably get through when I do a mass attack.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it looks like with Breath Weapon, people who are going monster heavy, they're just going to be like, oh, that's nice. You have sidekicks. They're all gone.
Well, the other thing then, too, is that obviously the combat step's going to be more interesting, but I think all decisions are going to be more interesting. And here's why. Earlier... in Dice Masters, there were only so many ways that you were going to spend your energy, especially if it was your opponent's turn. But you know, certain things were
really
going to field, or there were certain globals you were going to. Okay, well, he has that mask. I know what's coming. You know, there's a very small subset of things, and you know we're still going to know that from the globals that are there. But now, being able to use generic energy with Breath Attack, being able to you know, of course, still have globals available, being able to pay to equip characters with certain things. There's a lot more that you can do with an energy. So it's not so clear cut all the time. What, you know, we spoke before about having a lot more information with this game. Well, because we're diffusing that some, because there's a lot of times where you're going to have so many options as to what to do with the energy, or your opponent will, that it's not going to be clear how they're going to try to do it. So, you know, what do you do?
Right, it's not going to be, oh, he has a bolt, that means he's going to give something +1 attack.
Yeah.
Or, you know, he has a mask, he's going to use Professor X's global. It's, well, is he going to do that? Is he going to, you know, what is he doing with that spare energy? Or more likely, well, I have a feeling he's going to get this guy who gives bolt energy. Is he going to use that to pump a guy? Is he going to use that to knock out my sidekicks? Do I want to play my sidekicks or just roll them for energy instead?
Yep.
There's more possibilities, which makes the game more complex, which makes it more interesting.
Yeah, far more interesting decisions to make.
Hyper chess, yes. Not just chess.
The biggest thing that I have to reflect on, though, is that with the look and feel of this set, with the abilities that we're seeing, with the artwork, this is the total package. I think we can really steal some Magic players here. I'm just saying.
I like that. Or even D&D players.
Or D&D, of course, both. Yes, absolutely. But that's just me. Now,
we all
Evan,
know they love dice. So.
Oh, we sure do. Evan, let me ask you this then. Do you want to make any predictions now, you know, a little while away from the release of this set? Any predictions that you have about it? I have a couple, if you don't. Well, one big one. Anyway.
My main prediction is just we're going to see it, and I think... I have a feeling we've only seen the tip of the iceberg. I know we're really excited, but there's so much crazy stuff we haven't seen. I only know for sure one of the super rares. I think Dice Tower's alluded to a couple of others. Mm-hmm. I suspect the Tarrasque is one of them, which... I mean, I might just play the Tarrasque because it's the Tarrasque. But I have a really strong feeling that there's just going to be crazy stuff up and down. And honestly, it makes me wonder what we're going to see with DC, because they got to keep topping themselves, apparently.
Well, they sure do. I like a lot of the abilities that we've seen with DC so far, as well as the dice and the hero breakdown. We talked a lot about that a few episodes ago. My big prediction, I think, actually centers around the super rare that we know of, which is Red Dragon, Epic Dragon. This is a 7-bolt character. His abilities look awesome. Breath Weapon 3. Let's see here. While active once per turn when you use an action die effect, you may use a second copy of its effect. Then it's global. Once per turn, pay Bolt. When you purchase your next action die this turn, it costs 2 less, and you'll deal 1 damage to your opponent. So for that global to take effect, of course, you have to be buying the basic action dice, or else the damage isn't going to fire there, too. It's a conditional thing there. And overall, this looks really cool. But my prediction is that as awesome as this is, and as much as I love the artwork here and everything else about this card, this is going to be the knucklehead of this set. Early on with Avengers vs. X-Men, Wolverine Knucklehead was awesome, and people were like, oh, I can't beat this thing, and I don't know what's going on. And it turned out we actually had bigger fish to fry in that set. As cool as this one looks, I think its cost is just a little bit high, and as neat as its abilities are, Breath Weapon 3 is a little expensive if you're doing other stuff, though it has the board-clearing potential of a Cyclops if looks could kill, to throw back to Randy's segment. And the global requires a lot of... I mean, overall, it's a card that's awesome, but it's very expensive.
Yeah, though on the other hand, playing that and buying one-cost Power Bolts or something?
Yeah. Well...
run in fear.
That's fair, because... I have to say, I love this card, and if this is a super rare that I pull, I will not be disappointed. But I think that it's something that we might flock to very quickly initially, and then move to something else a little bit later, similarly to what we did with Knucklehead.
The one thing I'm wondering, though, and it's building off of this, since the global action, or basic actions, are all, so far, spells that we've seen, I'm really wondering, and we've seen Limited Wish as one of the non-basic actions. I'm getting the feeling that we're going to see a lot of, you know, additional actions coming out in D&D. It's not going to, you know, there'll be plenty of monsters and adventures and stuff, but we're going to see, I have a feeling we're going to see more than, like, the 2 or whatever non-basic actions we saw in each of the Marvel Dice Masters sets. I guess we'll see probably closer to Yu-Gi-Oh, which I think had like 4 or 5. And I'm thinking with stuff like Red Dragon, I think a couple of the others we've seen, like Beholder, you're going to start seeing people, like, maybe not unseriously bringing non-basic actions to the table.
Well, there are a lot of them.
I have a feeling they're using a lot of... I mean, Limited Wish has some real... You know, if you're a psychic, Limited Wish is your card.
Well, and you know what's really interesting about Limited Wish is that it's a non-basic action, and Randy points this out in the article, it's a non-basic action that doesn't have an energy type. That's pretty crazy. I mean, we haven't seen that yet.
Yeah.
Well, and there's a lot of ways then to use generic energy in this set too. So that
right.
makes the basic actions a little bit more viable because, you know, oh, well, I have these couple of basic actions that I rolled. Well, I guess I will Breath Weapon 3. Easy enough because I don't have to spend, you know, other stuff on it that I might need to buy a character. That's, yeah. So many
Red
more interesting...
Dragon, I wish you'd breathe fire all over these guys.
Yep. Oh, well. So many different... so many different things to be excited about with this set. The cards are enough to get excited about just how they look. But overall, I'm excited. I think that's probably gotten across, though.
Yeah, I mean, I if people haven't picked up that I'm really excited for this set, I have to imagine that whenever my mouth opens, you hear, like, smooth jazz as opposed to me speaking.
I hear smooth jazz, Evan.
If that's the case, I mean, great. I unless you don't like smooth jazz, then I'm really sorry. But I've almost started thinking I might want 2 gravity feeds, even though
yeah.
I know that's silly.
I
know that's silly, and 1 gravity feed will get me almost the entire set.
I've thought the same thing. All right, well, share with us, what are you excited about with this set? What mechanism inspires you? What character or artwork inspires you? What do you want to see with D&D? What are you pumped to play with? tell us. mailbag@thereservepool.com. Find us on Twitter @thereservepool. Follow us on iTunes, review us on iTunes, rather. Help us get the word out there. It does mean a lot. It's a very simple thing that you can do. If you would like to contribute to the show, you can do so by following the link on our page. We are still going to give the same show to everybody, regardless of anything else. We don't plan to change that, but any help you could give would be much appreciated. We have big things in the works. I've said this a lot to you individually, and I've said it, I think, on the podcast. Big things are happening, and we're so excited, and we can't wait to share them with all of you, but we can't do that yet. So thank you for spending your time with us. This is Dave.
This is Evan, and call D&D Dice Masters Dadum, because that's hilarious.
And this is The Reserve Pool. Thanks again. Bye.
And that's our outtake.
Likely.